History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned that they don't have to go untold. If we're willing to ask a few questions and take some time to listen, we might just end up hearing something that adds to our perspective in a powerful way. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really do find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. 80 years ago, thousands of Americans were about to end up in the Battle of the Bulge, and that includes the centenarian we get to meet today. Mervin Hogg just turned 100 in Wilmington, North Carolina, but I got to catch up with him in Fort Worth, Texas recently at the 90th Infantry Division Association reunion. You're going to be hearing more about that group and the tough hombres of the 90th Division in the weeks to come, but let's get a taste of Mr. Hogg's story, starting with his early days.
Grew up in Pittsburgh. In the Pittsburgh area, actually, it's Wilkinsburg, which is a suburb of Pittsburgh, on the east side. And born in Kansas.
What do you remember about your childhood? I'm imagining it was a little different from what kids experience now.
Good thing. My father, he taught anatomy at the University of Pittsburgh. And, of course, back in the 30s, it was 9 months, and then he was off 3 months in the summertime. He was born and raised on a farm, wheat farm out in Kansas, and had kinfolk out there. And so we'd pack up and go out to Kansas in the summertime. So I got to live on a farm in the summer and in the city in the winter.
What was Pittsburgh like before World War II?
Smoky.
Coal plants?
Oh, yeah. A lot of soot in the air. Of course, my father taught in the medical school. The medical school was built right above the Pitt Stadium. You could get up on the third, fourth, and fifth floor and look down in the stadium. We watched a lot of football games free.
Seeing as your birthday is December 5th, I'm just guessing you've got a memory of December 7th, 1941. You remember where you were and how you found out?
I was on Louise Anderson's front porch.
Were you up to no good?
No, that was the story. She was the girlfriend of a good friend of ours. And my brother and I happened to be down in the business area in Wilkinsburg, and we ran into Jack McMillan and Louise Anderson. She lived about a block and a half, 2 blocks from where we live. And we run into them. They were heading down to Louise's house. So we just fell in with them, brother and I. Four of us guys were with her, and we walked her home. And we all, four of us, were on her front porch. She went in the house and come back a minute or two later and said her brother was listening to Pearl Harbor, bombing of Pearl Harbor. That's when I heard about it. But I always like to say that I was on Louise Anderson's front porch.
And had you ever heard of Pearl Harbor before?
I don't remember whether I had or not.
Well, and how big was that news? I mean, how world-changing was that revelation that America's been bombed and there's a war that the U.S. is part of now?
We knew we were at war. We knew what was going to happen.
Did you know?
It was a matter of time. Of course, my brother had already graduated. I had not yet. He graduated in 41, spring of 41. I graduated spring of 42. So I was still in high school.
So how long was it till Uncle Sam got a hold of both of you?
43. Yeah, we waited for the draft. We figured the war, if we had enlisted, we'd have enlisted for 3 years, but we didn't figure it was going to last that long. And it didn't.
Were the two of you pretty close?
Oh, yeah, we were running together pretty close. It was just a year and a half difference.
So were you hoping you'd be able to serve together?
No, not particularly. Of course, we were both called up at the same time. But I had a hernia, and I had to get that repaired. So he went in May, and I didn't go in until September.
And how much do you know about what he did for the rest of the war?
Well, he went to infantry replacement training and went to North Africa. And his story was he was on the dock with a bunch of replacements ready to go to Anzio. But the 5th Army headquarters ran a search on people who had machine records experience. And they grabbed him and took him off the dock and sent him to 5th Army headquarters to work on his machines. So that's where he spent the war.
Which might have saved his life.
Very well.
Because Anzio was awful.
Yeah.
Wow. You're back home dealing with this hernia for a while. And then what? Did you have kind of a welcome to the Army moment that you remember?
Yeah, I went to Fort Meade where I was inducted and took all those tests, an IQ, an aptitude test, and a radio test. And I must have done pretty good on a radio test because they loaded a bunch of us and sent us down Mississippi, 63rd Division, which they were just starting up. And I reported in the 2nd Battalion Headquarters Company and reported to this first sergeant. And he looked at the report and he said, well, you were scheduled to go to radio school, but you were late getting here. And the school had already started, so we're going to put you in an anti-tank platoon. And I figured, well, that makes sense. And that's why I'm in my Army career. I wrote it up one time. I had a friend that I've been a part of a dance club. She'd be after me to write a memoir or something, so I wrote one. Got a copy of it up in there.
Good. Well, maybe we can pick some highlights from it here as you're sharing with us. That's a pretty frequent experience for guys at this time, that the government plays a little switcheroo. You think you're going this way. And in your brother's case, it was very fortunate for him.
My career's been doing that.
So what did that mean once they put you in the anti-tank?
I was first gunner. I learned how to shoot one of those things.
Explain that to us. How would that work? Because most people have never fired one of those before.
Yeah, the first gunner handles the gun, the trigger, the sight, and he actually handles the gun, has to, because they're shooting at moving targets. Mm-hmm. And the second gunner, why, he loads, operates the breech and loads it. And then you've got 6 other people, muscle men, that handle the gun carriage and so on. And so I was the first gunner.
And what kind of vehicle is this?
1.5-ton truck. Mm-hmm. It was a 6-wheel truck, you know, tandem, rear wheels on.
So you got to train a little bit on that in the States before you went over?
On the 37s, yeah.
Uh-huh.
37-millimeter gun. Got to shoot a couple of dummies. There were only 2 of us hit target out of 18 in the regiment. There were 9 in the anti-tank company, and then there were 3 battalions that had 9 more. There were 18, and out of 18 gunners, only 2 of us hit target the first time, and they had 25 rounds altogether, so that left them 7 more. So 2 of us started the second one, and the fella that hit the target the first time got it second time, and then I fired the second time. Target disappeared. I let it a little bit too much, and I hit the leading edge of the thing. And
no one else gets to shoot today.
Nobody else got to shoot. They didn't have a spare target, no way to repair the one I busted.
Uh-huh. You made your mark.
I was glad to get away from that company commander. We'd already beat all his squads and getting a gun in action, and I went busting his target.
It's a good way to make a first impression.
Yeah.
And I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember how you felt emotionally about the idea of going overseas?
I know it's going to happen.
You're resigned to it.
Oh, yeah.
So when did you go overseas, and what was that journey like?
It was the 90th. We went overseas with the 90th. And, well, we were on the Erics, and we left the first time around the 1st of April or a little bit before that. And then we had to turn around and go back to New York because something broke.
You got halfway across the Atlantic and the ship?
No, we just got out of Long Island Sound. We just barely got out of the Atlantic Ocean. They say it was one of the engines failed. It had 2 diesel engines on it. But the rumor that we heard was a refrigeration unit that broke down, so I don't know which it was. But we had to turn around and back into New York, tied up for about 3-4 days, looking up at New York at the Empire State Building, MPs all over the place.
Not letting you off the ship?
Oh, no. They wouldn't let us off that ship.
So close, but yet so far.
Yeah, one fella let down. He said, I could almost see my home up there.
And had you ever been aboard a ship before you sailed across the Atlantic? So what did you find when you arrived? You go over to England first?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we stayed in England. We got into Liverpool Harbor on Easter Sunday. It was the 8th of April. And we stayed there until late May. Then we moved to another camp down in Wales outside of Portsmouth, was it? I think it was.
Are you starting to get some of that anticipation of what's coming? Were you in the loop as to how close you guys were to making this invasion?
We knew things were happening, but when they started handing out ammunition, we knew it was serious. So that was when the rumors started, and everybody got the N-O-R right. We figured Norway or North Africa. Nobody guessed Normandy.
It wasn't Norway or North Africa. It was Normandy. When did it become real for you?
When they loaded up the ammunition.
Yeah.
Because the next day we were boarded ship. It was on the 3rd, they passed out ammo, gave us our anti-tank mines. Because I ended up in the mine platoon there because when they got into the 90th, because I'd been with the 63rd and basic and got transferred to the 90th, got in an anti-tank company, and that was again a change because originally I was put in a gun platoon, which I figured was where it was, and then all of a sudden I found I was in a mine platoon, and I was found out that was a misfit platoon of the regiment, and I couldn't figure out how I ended up in the misfit platoon of the regiment.
You didn't fit in with the misfits? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, I got along fine with them.
So they hand out ammo on the 3rd.
They weren't Beetle Baileys now.
Yeah.
They weren't gold bull bricks by any means. So they were just the opposite. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of mischief in that outfit.
Well, maybe that's why you're still here, huh?
That's partly it.
So they hand out ammo on the 3rd. When did you guys actually load up the ships?
4th, next day.
So you're out in that channel for a little
while. We were out in the Carter Channel on D-Day.
There aren't too many people on the planet today who can tell us what that looked like, what that felt like, what you experienced. What do you remember about that? What'd you see?
There's nothing to see. Water.
Yeah. And where'd you land?
Utah Beach. Nice, calm, pretty day. Sunny, channel was calm. The lull in the fighting. There was no noise going on. There was a cruiser somewhere 6-7 miles up the beach. It was shooting around every now and then. But other than that, it was very quiet. Then he ran that LCI right up on the beach. We got off in about 2-3 inches of water. And we walked on up across the causeway about 3-4 miles inland.
Was that the calm before the storm for you?
It was.
And over the years, I'm sure that you've seen what happened at the other beaches, right? You read about it.
I've heard about it.
Yeah.
Seen pictures of it.
Does that give you some perspective on your own experience of June 6th to 44?
Well, of course, on all beaches, as a mess. Utah, I don't know about Utah, on D-Day, wasn't same situation. Of course, it was a different situation there because the 101st Airborne managed to get control of the west end of those two important causeways. There was an error. The 4th Division, when they landed the first wave, they landed about 1,000 yards south of where they were supposed to land, which was fortunate because that was where the 101st managed to get control of the causeway. So they got inland before the real fighting started. Mm-hmm. I don't know what happened after that.
Merv Hogg came ashore on Utah Beach on June 8, 1944. Within a few days, the 19-year-old would find out what war was all about. We'll hear about that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 100-year-old Mervin Hogg of Wilmington, North Carolina, originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but in June of 1944, he was a long way from the U.S., coming ashore in Normandy with the 90th Infantry Division's 358th Regiment.
The 11th. Mm-hmm. We landed on the 8th, but it was the 11th before we actually got it. That was when all hell broke loose.
Tell me about it. Where were you and how did you experience that?
It's just shooting, artillery, mortar, a lot of noise.
Mortar shells landing around you?
Yeah, 88 tried to get one of our trailers, and it's a good thing they didn't. It's 2,000 pounds of TNT in that trailer. If they'd hit it, that'd have been the end of it.
Wow.
And they put one round over that trailer, and then they put one round under the truck, and then they put the third round in the tree behind the trailer again.
So if those 80...
must have been a branch or something of a tree that was in the way that they couldn't hit the trailer. They went over and under and over.
That's a trailer that your truck is pulling?
Yeah.
So if one of those 88 shells had connected, you would have been blown sky
high. I was
high.
In a ditch right alongside of it.
Taking some cover.
Uh-huh. After that third round, I got over in the other side of the edge row.
And you're laughing about it now, but I'm guessing you weren't laughing
on
June 11th, 44.
Not about it then.
And I'm not trying to be melodramatic.
Yeah,
if you don't want to say anything else about it, you don't have to. But I'm just, can you help those of us who've never been in that situation understand what a helpless feeling that is?
That's right. I mentioned that in that memoir I wrote, but until you get used to it. You learn after a time that you rely on your hearing so much that more than people realize. And you can hear those artillery shells, most of them, except the 88s, you don't hear them coming. But all the artillery shells, mortar shells, you hear them coming. And you know whether they're going to come close to you or they're going somewhere else. And if they're going somewhere else, you don't pay attention to them. And 90% of them are going someplace else.
What about the other 10%?
Look out.
And there's not a whole lot you can do, is there?
No.
So you're in a foxhole or a trench or?
Well, if you get in Normandy, you could get behind a hedgerow if you're lucky.
Yeah.
Because they'll hit the hedgerow instead of you.
And I'm just imagining, you know, if you got there that early, there had to be a few close calls along the way where you thought it might have had your number.
Oh, yeah.
Can you take us through any of those situations?
Well, they say if you see it coming, it doesn't get you. And one day in Dillingen, that was over in Germany across the Saar River, there were six of us who got pinned down underneath the railroad platform. And fortunately, I was standing behind a rifleman who was a little bit taller than I was, and his shoulder come up about that on my chin. And a mortar shell or something landed in a railroad out of front of it, and I saw something coming. I didn't have no chance to get out of the way, but fortunately that thing was spent, and it got him in the right shoulder. It hit me in the face. But it wasn't fabulous. It was already spent. It didn't hurt him. He started cussing. $1 million wound, and I didn't. I was standing behind him, and thank God. He had me stand there, would hit me right in the throat.
And how do you, when you're dealing with situations like that day after day after day, what keeps you going? What enables you to endure that and make it to the next day?
Oh, I don't know. You just get over it. When it's over. And the next day's the next day.
Did you get to be pretty close with the guys on your truck?
Not really. There wasn't any real... With me, I was a replacement that was sent into the company at Fort Dix. The people who had gone through training and basic and so together, why, they were pretty much acquainted, well acquainted, buddied up. But those of us who were replacements, well, we were accepted, but we weren't really part of the clan.
This may seem elementary or just basic, but for someone who's never done what you did, can you explain the scope of your responsibilities and your duties, what you were there for?
Well, I ended up being, this is a joke, the regiment's resident explosive expert. And that has its stories, too.
Don't hold out on us, number.
I learned one time early on that you don't tell lieutenants that what they want to do is not going to work. And it was back in the winter. Everything was frozen. The ground was frozen. And the Air Corps had dropped a bomb in the road, a big crater in the road. And they wanted a pathway around through a stand of small trees and wanted to cut a down path through there. And everybody was chopping down these trees, listening to just small stuff. I meant there was a hump in the ground. And it was frozen solid. And the lieutenant wanted me to put a block of TNT on there and level off that. I said, it ain't gonna work. And he got mad, told me to do it anyhow. So I went ahead and set up a half-pound block of TNT on it. We got out of there, boom. Went back and looked. And if you knew somebody had done something, you could tell that something had been done. But that hump was still there. I did not say I told you so.
You didn't have to.
But I was saying, then there was another experience. It was crazy. It was after the war was over. But somebody in service company, they were in Nauberg, we were in Schwarzenfeld, about 15 miles in between on occupation duty, and they'd found some ammunition out in the woods, way out in some woods. They dug a hole and had some German PWs working for them, find that ammunition, put it in the hole, poured gasoline on it, set it on fire, and something exploded and just blew the stuff out. They wanted to blow that stuff up. They gave me a stick of stuff that looked like composition too, but it was hard like TNT, and fuse and blasting cap. They wanted me to go out there with them. We got the Germans to put all this stuff back in that hole, and I knew what was going to happen. And I didn't dare say anything to that lieutenant. So I put that stuff in there, and I cut a nice long piece of fuse. And, you know, I told a fellow, because one of them had given me one of their truck drivers to drive me out there, and we had these two Germans. And I told Pariso to take the truck and the two Germans, go back down the road the way we come, about 400 yards, and wait. And I told that lieutenant and his driver to get in the Jeep and start the engine because I wanted to make sure that engine was running before I lit that fuse. I lit the fuse and I got in the Jeep and we went up the other direction and I heard a boom. And we come back, and I was back in that Jeep, and I just say, please don't stop. Please don't stop. Myself. We kept going. And I began to get a little bit worried about the two Germans that hit Pariso and had run off with his truck. And finally, we went around a bend. There's the three of them standing there with their eyes kind of big. And what the hell are you doing all the way down here? And Pariso said, well, we went down the road about 100 yards. We had an explosion. A mortar shell come and land about 30 yards from us. We got on. I said, well, damn it, Pariso, I told you to go 400 yards. Now, another one of my experiences with lieutenants.
I can tell you, I have nothing but respect. And just, to put a bow on that one, so this is after Germany has surrendered, but you guys almost blew yourselves up.
It didn't blow me up. I knew better. I knew what was going to happen.
So, as the explosives expert, as you said, whether that was an official title or not, were there times, too, where you guys had to try to detect mines or eliminate enemy explosives?
Yeah, mines. We were out looking for them from time to time. Engineers did most all that work. And really, we didn't have much to do, so we did all kinds of things. We were just tagging along, you know. So, but any time regiment ran into something, they needed somebody in a hurry to do something, well, they'd call us out, and we'd end up doing it.
I'm getting the sense that you kind of got desensitized to the danger that was surrounding you on a daily basis. Is that fair to say? Or is that just the effect of all the years since?
Yeah, like I say, you get used to some of that stuff and where you're not concerned about it. Mm-hmm. The nuclear warfare, those six rocket things the Germans had, they were always a problem because those six things were spread out in space and you never knew where they were going until the first one hit. You just never knew because you couldn't, your ears wouldn't tell you where they were.
It's the screaming meanies?
No, yeah. You never knew where they were going until the first one hit.
Did you lose anybody over there that you had come to know or appreciate?
Oh, yeah.
And you're a young man. I mean, you're 20 years old, huh? Not even. 19 when you went over?
Yeah.
How did you handle that element of it when somebody you know that you've been fighting next to isn't going home?
Yeah, it can be painful. I lost your lieutenant that way. We lost several people that way. Most of them we lost was in Normandy. I didn't really know them very well.
Does that make you wonder if you're next? If that might happen to you?
Yeah. The only worry I had really was the Pacific. I never thought I'd come back from the Pacific. I was really happy when that war ended.
Were you thinking they were going to send you over there after VE
Day? Yeah, the 90th Division. No doubt would have gone over there if it hadn't been for the atomic bomb.
So you're one of those who feels those bombs saved your life?
Definitely.
I know some elements of your division ended up liberating some concentration camps over there.
Flossenbürg.
Were you there at Flossenbürg?
Yep. We were the first ones there on duty. A lot of people will argue about that. But
who was first?
Well, we were 2nd Cavalry found it, reported it apparently to regiment. And regiment may have sent somebody out to take a look at it, but they do what they always do, guard it. They grabbed us and said, go to guard it. But we had no officer, so we were no official thing. We just had a platoon sergeant, and then we were replaced the next day by a platoon from one of the field artillery battalions. And they had an officer, so they claimed to be the first official. But they weren't.
Because you were there.
Well, when we got there, my platoon sergeant and I was acting squad leader, kind of, and we had another squad leader. 3-4 of us were there in the admin building trying to figure out what do you do when you guard a concentration camp. We had no idea. Don't go garden. We just ended up breaking up and doing whatever come to mind.
What about even the concept of a concentration camp and what the Jewish people and other people had been through for those years? Were you guys aware of it before you got there to Flossenbürg?
Oh, well, yeah, we knew about them, sure.
You'd heard about some of the other camps being liberated?
Well, I guess we knew about them before they were liberated.
Mm-hmm. Did you see some things there at Flossenbürg that were hard to see or hard to think about?
A little bit. I wasn't very curious. I knew what I was going to see if I got into barracks. Some of the people did. It's terrible. So I found a little old wooden watchtower out in the back alongside of the camp. That I made a mistake, I think. I got up in there. Of course, it was a parapet in the roof in case it rained, so I was happy enough to be up there. I got a visitor. A fellow wanted to come up there and get to the top of the tower. So I said, sure. He spoke a little English. Said he was writing a history on it, but he was drawing some sketches from different vantage point. I wanted a copy of that history for a long time, and it's 2012. Jörg Skribalite is the way I would pronounce his name. The way he pronounces it is impossible, but he is the director of the Flossenbürg Museum, and he visited the 90th Association meeting in 2012. And I asked him about that history. And he said, oh, yeah, he has it. So I asked him to email me a copy of it, which he did. About a week later, I had a copy of that, the original German and English language translation. So after 67 years, I got a copy of it.
And this is what the guy who came up in the tower with you was working on at the time?
Yeah. Emil Lizak is a Czechoslovakian national. That is a newspaper correspondent.
So was it worth the wait to learn what you'd been waiting to read for all those years?
It was worth the wait, just getting it.
What did you learn about what had happened there that you guys, by your very presence, helped put an end to?
No, we didn't really learn anything. We already knew about what was expected. Of course, that's where Dietrich Bonhoeffer was hanged.
Not very long before you guys got there.
2 weeks.
Yeah. And did you see any of the remaining prisoners that were liberated?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We met several of them there in the admin building. That was another story.
Well, let's see if we can get that story when we come back. Time for our final break, but we'll hear more from 100-year-old Merv Hogg when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-530-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode recorded at this year's 90th Infantry Division Association reunion. That is quite an organization, and we're going to be hearing more about it in the weeks to come. When we left off, 100-year-old Mervin Hogg was describing what he encountered while participating in the liberation of Flossenbürg concentration camp. Some of those inmates he met left an impression on him.
One of them was a Russian army captain. And I don't know, he must have not have been there very long. He was too physical. Too good a physical condition. But he got hold of me, and then I started doing that, almost knocked my helmet off my head.
He was shaking you because he was so glad
to see you? Oh, yeah, happy. Mm. He's shaking me. And we were standing there talking about it was him and there were two others, I think it was. And then another one came in, you know, very hospitable. He was going to feed us the guests with a big brick of Limburger cheese, and you could smell that stuff coming.
Well, and as infamous as Limburger is for not smelling good, there were probably things there that smelled worse.
Yeah, some places, no doubt. I didn't go into any of the building. I got up in that watchtower. I stayed there.
And you said that Russian officer, you know, was in such good physical shape, he must not have been there too long. But you saw some of the folks who had been there for a while.
Yeah.
Was that jarring to your senses to see human bodies in that kind of condition?
I didn't, like I say, I didn't get into that. I didn't go looking. There was one died overnight. I saw his feet. They covered him up alongside one of the barracks. But they were still dying after we liberated.
Well, and I know you've talked about this before and you've written some memoirs, but there still seems to be this phenomenon of people arguing over history and some people saying, no, that didn't really happen, or no, it wasn't really that bad, or, you know, this couching of this time in history that it was something less than this atrocity. What's your perspective on all that as someone who saw things firsthand and who was
immature, there? Immature thinking. That's all you can do. It's just childishness.
For those of us who weren't there, what do we need to know about it?
That it can happen. It can happen anywhere.
And was there any satisfaction for you personally, knowing that you guys helped save some lives there, put an end to what had been happening there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're glad we could do it.
And it sounds like you saw and heard and felt the gratitude that the liberated prisoners had for you guys as liberators.
Well, I would, very little contact, really. There were a few people there, Flossenbürg, who liberated, but they were glad to see us, of course.
And I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you. I'm just asking some of the things I can imagine are part of your story, but you're the expert here. Was VE Day a big deal for you?
VE Day on the 5th of May, I think it was the 5th of May, the platoon was sent into a little town in Czechoslovakia. The name of it then was Bergreichenstein. Kaspersky Hory is the name today. There was SS Convalescent Hospital. I call it a convalescent. I don't know what else to call it. Hospital in town operating. 140 SS there in that. And the squad that I was acting squad leader, I was sent out to guard it. So there was 7 of us and 140 of them. And it was a big school building. You can see it on the internet. It's still there. It's an elementary school now. It must have been before they took it over as a hospital. And a gymnasium in the back. And there was an ante room in the gymnasium with some wooden bunks that we took over. We had SS in the gym and we had SS. And we were surrounded. And a little cubby hole at the end of that had the ambulance drivers. They had taken over that. The head ambulance driver had a key to the medicinal alcohol locker.
Uh-oh.
And we had one fellow in the squad who couldn't pass up the sauce. So the ambulance driver kept Bush kind of happy in the evening. But there was one SS sergeant. We know all the ambulatory all had Red Cross armbands, but we knew they weren't all related for medics. And there was one sergeant didn't like us at all. I was a little bit leery of him. But then on VE Day, they had a radio, too. The ambulance drivers did. We listened to Churchill's announcement of the termination of hostilities on the radio, and that was the end of the war. And I said, fine, the war's over. That was it, far as we were concerned. But that evening, why, an ambulance driver got a little more of the sauce than he usually did. Butch got feeling pretty good, but this sergeant got feeling pretty good, too. He had this gathering back there around those ambulance drivers. I went back there to see how things were going. Butch, he threw an arm around my shoulder, and his German sergeant, he threw an arm. I was standing there between those two. All I could think was, Lord, why me? I wasn't about to rock the boat. I managed to get disentangled and got away from there. Thought that as long as they're happy, I'm happy.
I could see.
That was the way the war ended.
I could see where that's a VE Day memory that sticks with you.
A crazy war.
Yeah.
But we got along with them all right. We didn't mess with them. They didn't mess with us. Then the next night, just after dark, along come who was left of an SS Panzer Division, general, some officers, and about another 250 Germans. And I had to put them up for the night.
And there's still only seven of you guys?
Yeah. Well, there was 20 of us in town.
Uh-huh.
But it was a maternity hospital, and one squad was there, and the other. The first squad was down to Burgermeister's office.
But timing is everything, because a few weeks earlier, if 20 of you were dealing with 400 SS troops, that wouldn't have been a very good situation.
No.
Huh.
Well, it really wasn't a problem. We were the best friends they had, whether they knew it or not. We were, and they knew it, really.
To keep them safe at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they were worried about the Russians, and there were rumors around that we were going to turn all German prisoners over to the Russians. But those orders never came down.
And that might have saved their lives.
They were SS. They'd been butchered.
The Russians would have executed them. Now, we hit some touch points, but you were over there for a year. Are there any other moments, experiences, things that stand out that still come back to your memory really vividly all these years later?
Oh, here and there, a lot of things.
What are the things you think are important for us to remember? Those of us who didn't live through this time in history, who weren't over there eating, breathing, sleeping, living it on a daily basis.
It's part of what's in the history books, if they don't ever get it right.
Well, this is your chance to set us straight, so we get it right.
Yeah.
You've been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., I'm sure?
Yeah. We opened it.
You were there the first
day. The 90th Division opened the thing. Yeah. We hadn't had a two-star general with us. We wouldn't have had it. But we had it set up for a memorial service there, and it wasn't open when we got there. But we had to put some pressure on them to open the place up.
Back in 2004?
Mm-hmm.
So you were there that first day?
Mm-hmm.
When you look at that wall of gold stars, and you see 400,000 lives represented by that, what do we need to remember about those guys? Could have been you, could have been your brother. But those guys who paid the ultimate price, how should we remember them all these years later?
Oh, I don't know. It happened. These things happen. Too bad, but of course I know people buried at all three of those cemeteries, Normandy, Belgium, and St. Avold. They never mentioned St. Avold. I don't know why, because it's the largest of all the cemeteries.
And you've been back there?
I haven't been to the cemetery. Well, I was back in Germany when, in 2000, we made the tour across from Frankfurt on to Prague, and then it was over there in 2004 when they had a big celebration in northern Lorraine. My wife and I went over there.
Did that give you a little different perspective, seeing how life was for people there 60 years later because of what all you guys did?
They were very appreciative. There's a real long story about that. I don't know if you've heard it or not.
Feel free. I'm all ears. As long as you got time, we got time.
No, the way the story goes, it was Ray Bell Jr. and his sister organized three tours. One of them was, in 98, was into Normandy, and 99 was into the Bulge, and then 2000 was from the Rhine to Prague on the route of the 90th Division through there. Well, in 99, the one in Belgium, there was one of the people on that tour had been wounded in Metzervisse, down in that northern Rhine area. Now, that part of the country was Lorraine and Alsace had been booted back and forth between Germany and France for years, and people didn't know what they were. In 1940, when the Germans got in there, why, they annexed it, and all the young men were subjected to conscription in the German army, and they were all sent over into the Eastern Front. There were some 40,000 of them were killed. And then when in 45, 46, 44, we liberated, I think it was in 46, it was annexed back to France. Then all those German soldiers that lived there started coming back, of course in German uniforms, but they were coming back into France. And the people, they didn't know whether they were German, French, what they were. And they just quit celebrate anything. It was in 45 there was some celebrating of their liberation, but then they just quit. But this fellow in 99 who had been wounded in Metzervisse wanted to go down there and visit where he had been wounded. So he and a friend rented an automobile and drove down to Metzervisse. And they got involved in an automobile accident with a drunk Frenchman. And of course he ended up in a hospital, wasn't seriously hurt. And I got the chief of police, Pascal Moretti, involved. And Pascal Moretti, you're going to wonder what these two Americans were doing in his little town. It was no tourist thing or nothing. And so they told him what it was. And he got interested in it, and he got the historian from a high school interested, and people interested in it, and they created this 44 thing and decided to celebrate their anniversary, 60th anniversary of their liberation. And they invited all the people from the 90th Association and 95th Division, 3rd Cavalry Group, to come down there, come over there and visit, and all we had to do was to pay to get there and get home. And we had a big celebration for a week.
All because the police chief of police got called in on a car wreck.
Yeah.
How about that? So when you think back over 100 years, is there something that you would say you're most thankful for or most proud of?
Be alive. I dance. I still dance.
Still dance.
Oh, I tell you, I have a ball on Friday nights.
You're one of the last of the tough hombres here. What should we know about the 90th Infantry Division and the guys that you served with?
I think it was one of the more civilized divisions that we had. Bad conduct was, there wasn't very much of it, very little. You'll find it with some other divisions why they people misbehaved pretty badly, but the 90th Division didn't.
And did any of that explosive expert experience ever come in handy after the war?
Nope. The big firecrackers in the war. Half-bound TNT makes a hell of a firecracker.
That's what I didn't ask you about. Coming back home to the States when it was all over. What was that like for you?
That was courtesy of the U.S. Navy.
Where'd you come in?
New York. We were the first troop ship out of Le Havre, the USS Savannah, a light cruiser. We'd been outfitted, about 400 of us on a board ship. Got out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and run into a hurricane.
Let me help you some more.
Oh, that was a rough ride. You know, the stern of that ship coming up out of the water and then propeller, boom, boom, boom. We didn't get any sleep that night. I got up on deck the next day, and I could look down at the ocean on this side, and I looked down at the ocean on that side. And Jim was doing it. It busted something loose on the front end, blew oil up on the side of the ship, and turned that ship into the wind, and then just 5 knots, just enough to maintain steerage through the rest of that storm that day.
So after everything you went through in Normandy and the bulge and everything after that, a hurricane almost took you out.
Yeah.
So when you came into New York, I'm sure you saw that
Statue of Liberty. There she stood. I was happy to see it.
Did that have a little more meaning than it would have had?
Yeah.
And how about seeing your family again?
We finally got off of the Savannah on a train. They took us to Kilmer. Fettis gave us a lecture on re-enlisting, put us back on another train, and we spent the whole night wandering around over eastern Pennsylvania. I think we went on every spur line in the state. Ended up in Indiantown Gap, got processed, then the next day, 2nd of December, I had that piece of paper that said honorable discharge and a ticket to get on the train to go to Pittsburgh. And a bunch of us got on, and I was lucky. I got on that car first, and a couple of good-looking gals were sitting in there, and I got sitting down right directly off us up. So I had nice company, but they weren't expecting to be on a troop train. They lived in Altoona, and they had got off the train there. I went on into Pittsburgh, got off at East Liberty, got a cab, flat broke, got home, and told the cabby, wait a minute. I went to the house and got some money to pay the cab driver. That was my return home.
That had to be a good day.
Next day was even better. All my clothes, of course, had been in storage. I had to get them laundered and cleaned and so on. So all I had was a uniform and a girl that I'd been dating some. The people thought we were serious. We weren't really, but I had a date with her when I got home anyhow. But we had one bathroom in the house that we were living in. It was one old house in Wilkinsburg. My sister had bought an expensive bar of perfume soap, and she was very careful to keep that in her bedroom, usually. But that night when she got through, she left a bar of soap on the edge of the bathtub, and I wanted to take a bath, and so I used that soap. I was the best smelling she all night long and into the next morning, I could still smell that stuff.
A welcome change, I'm sure.
That was my first experience getting home.
I realize I didn't ask you really about the bulge, and everyone talks about
cold. Cold.
And you're from Pittsburgh. It gets cold in Pittsburgh.
Oh, yeah.
But not Battle of the Bulge cold.
But a house to live in.
So describe for us, give us that perspective. How bad was it in the Bulge, and where did you have to sleep?
It was cold. Couldn't build a fire because smoke Germans had seen it. They small smoke away, but they let them have it.
And were you sleeping out in the snow in a foxhole, if you could dig one?
Some, but not old wrecky houses and barns and stuff like that usually.
Well, like I said, if there's anything I left out that you think is important, feel free to share. But I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us stories nobody else could tell us. Is there anything else that you think those of us that didn't live through what you did ought to understand about it?
Well, there's a story about the Christmas, about the old innkeeper, the mean old innkeeper. I changed my mind because one time I learned, and this is true, it's been true for centuries, that people sleep with large animals for the heat, the body heat. And we found a stable, had a couple of horses or cows, I think, and it was nice and warm in there. And, oh, we were going to enjoy that. The officer came in, get out of here. But I began to realize years later that that mean old innkeeper, he slept in the stable with the animal in the wintertime.
You were stealing his spot.
Yeah. So he let Mary have his bed. I told the preacher that one time. He didn't like it.
You didn't say you were from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Oh, no.
Well, the days are still merry and bright for 100-year-old Mervyn Hogg, and fitting to end on a Christmas note showcasing the sense of humor we heard throughout this conversation, even though so many of the things he saw and experienced in World War II were no laughing matter. We're just about out of time on Hometown Heroes for today, but I want to thank Merv's fellow 90th Division veteran Vern Schmidt for inviting me to their reunion, and Nancy Rasmussen from the Association for facilitating my meeting with Mr. Hogg, and the other special folks you're going to hear from in future episodes. And thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.